you know, it can be called a lot of things. You know, it can be defined in a lot of ways, but it's the periodic loss of an automatic ability. You know, it's involuntary tension leading to not being able to perform as you desire in things that you have learned, you have mastered at a certain level. You know, we never call a bad golfer, and we never look at a golfer who's never been good and say, hey, they got the yes. We just call them a bad golfer, right?
Welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast, presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne. Thanks for joining us. And hey, shout out to Titleist right off the top, going 4-for-4 in the majors this year. Way to go, Titleist. If you listen to this podcast, that should come as no surprise, because you'll know that the Pro V1, it's the best combination of speed, spin, and feel in the game, while the Pro V1X, it gives you a higher flight and firmer feel. Both deliver long distance, consistent flight, soft feel, and drop and stop control. So no wonder it was Titleist that was hit. Think about it. It was a Titleist that was hit the fewest time in each of the 2022 majors. Pretty cool. Good on you. And good on you for joining us today for an episode that, well, it's about something that isn't that easy to talk about. Not the S word, but the Y word. And while shanks, shanks can be amusing. They can be funny, and frankly, within a few lessons, you should be able to fix them. But the yips, there I went ahead and I said that as well, they really are no laughing matters. They've laid waste to golf careers and led plenty of golfers down some very dark emotional paths. Now, in order to understand this awful phenomenon better, we reached out to the yips doctor, not his official title, but we'll call him that for our purposes, performance coach Ward Jarvis. Ward has worked with pros like Lucas Glover and Brendan Todd, among others. He helped Brendan Todd through some yip nightmares, some full swing yip nightmares that we're going to talk about on the pod. Even if you don't have the yips, and let's pray that you don't, Ward is a top coach with a lot to share to help your game and your life. We get into some pretty interesting territory here, and he shares it all here, so do stay tuned. His path to becoming a tour coach, from being a caddy to a firefighter and now an expert on the mental game and the intersection of mind, body, and environment. It is, his path itself is fascinating. And do you know about flow? Do you have flow? Probably, even if you have some, you don't have enough, so do stick around. Of course, we bring you people with stories like Ward's because of your support. So big day coming up on the calendar. To show our appreciation in a very tangible way, Member Appreciation Day, it's July 27th. We are doubling your member discount on golfersjournal.com. So that is 40% off everything in the shop for premium members and 20% for standard and digital members. So now is like a really good time if you're thinking about upgrading your membership so you get the premium gift, you get more links, soul money, all those great things that come with being a premium subscriber. Up that subscription and you're going to get all the way up to 40% off. Again, you know, the premium subscription with the extras certainly pays for itself. That is July 27th. Don't miss it. We also appreciate our sponsors from the pages of the Golfers Journal. They are not eligible for the discount, but they are Titleist, Link Soul, FootJoy, Oakley, Links and Kings, Scotty Cameron, and Charles Schwab. Thanks again for listening, everyone. And now let's turn things over to Coach Ward Jarvis, a guy who didn't let a stutter hold him back. In fact, it was his stuttering that probably was the thing that led him to becoming golf's leading expert on the yips and a person who's helping scores of people overcome the seemingly impossible obstacles in their own lives. So Ward, your story in golf, your journey in golf it's fascinating. So give us some of the highlights, if you will.
It definitely is. You know, my story reminds me of Steve Jobs' commencement speech at Stanford. You know, one of the main points he made there is that, you know, in the middle of life, it's hard to connect the dots. But sometimes looking back, we had the opportunity to actually connect dots. And that's really cool. So, you know, I grew up around the game of golf. That was kind of the first thing I was good at. Also, I grew up stuttering as a stuttering kid. So, you know, I didn't know why I was successful at golf and then got the yips at 16, which effectively kind of took away my competitive days. You know, I didn't know why I stuttered. I got to college and played a year in college and then basically called it quits on my golf career. Went on to study religion at the master's level. Got out. Wow. And kind of had an epiphany that I really didn't want to teach religion the rest of my life and argue religious points with other scholars. And that's kind of what I had gone to school for. So it was another kind of dot in my life that, you know, why did I do that? But I enjoyed it. And at that time I had some relationships with some guys, some professional golfers, and caddying is one thing I always kind of wanted to do. And I was still single, footloose, fancy free, no kids. So basically hit the road back in 2009 and became a caddy on what's now the Korn Ferry Tour. In December of 2010, I met my wife-to-be. We fell in love. I decided I need to get off the road. But the last guy I caddied for was a young pro named Brendan Todd. And Brendan had just come back to the Korn Ferry Tour at that time and having lost his card after his rookie season on tour. And he was in the midst of what he now calls his first bout with the full swing yips, and which meant that he would hit two or three tee shots around off the property, more or less. And he went on to miss 15 cuts that year. And I went on to move back home, and I became a firefighter in my hometown. I had kept up with Brendan's career. You know, Brendan got worked through that first bout, got back out on tour, won the Byron Nelson in 2014, came two spots away from making the Ryder Cup in 2015, and I just saw all that was amazing in and of itself. And during this time, kind of what got me into studying the brain and looking into brain science was not really golf, but it was stuttering. You know, as a kid and growing up, I'd always kind of made a mental note that my experience with stuttering and my experience with the yips felt exactly the same. You know, they both resisted a type of effort. You know, you couldn't really try your way out of them. They were both really chaotic experiences as far as mentally and emotionally. And they were both very, very situational. You know, sometimes it was perfectly okay. Like, and so I started applying myself to studying stuttering at a deeper level, because in my job as a firefighter, it was really weird. My troubles were very contextual. In emergency situations, my stuttering was a lot less severe, if present at all. My attention was just kind of in different places. It was always kind of in the non-emergency traffic that really I had my greatest struggles. And by that, I mean just getting on the radio and calling our truck back into the station, or saying just checking the radios in the morning. And so it was always kind of in those situations where I had a lot of trouble. And I started studying it and really got into the neuroscience of it. And all along, I just started thinking about golf and like how this information about how the brain works and how, you know, how to work through it could really work well in golf. And I remember back to the person, Brendan Todd, and I still had his phone number. And I said, by this time I had sketched out kind of a system of, you know, how I would go about helping someone on the mental aspects of performance, you know, reaching their goals, overcoming their obstacles. And I called up Brendan, never expecting him to take my call. This was in 2018. Brendan had effectively missed 52 cuts in a row. He was basically down to about two tournaments a year on past champion status. And I just thought my ideas, my story would connect with him. And so I called him up. That was August of 2018. And the long story short is we've talked every week since then. And during our time together, Brendan went on to miraculously get his card back in 2019, piece things back together, won two events in 2019, almost a third in a row. So it was a big, big story in the world of golf and just opened up incredible doors for me. And like you said, I've had an opportunity to apply these ideas, this system I've developed.
It's fantastic, Ward. I want to get into some of those systems and some of those ideas for sure. But I just love the, you know, a theologian, firefighting caddy, you know, now working with some of the best golfers, you know, in the world, you know, as a performance coach. Because, you know, sometimes at the Golfers Journal, people will reach out and say, you know, how do I get into golf? I want to do something in the golf space. And there's just so many different paths and so many different ways to get there. Are you sort of known as the Yips guy now, as sort of the doctor for the Dr. Yips?
I certainly, I guess you could say that. I don't, Brendan and I, we barely even talked about the Yips in our time together, really. I mean, it was up front and dealing with kind of the lows of the experience and kind of piecing back a way to have some structure. So I definitely, some of my players, it basically starts with the Yips. Sometimes it stays with the Yips. But it's kind of evolved into kind of being a type of practice coach. You know, we deal a lot about practice, preparing, habits off the course and habits, you know, on the course, you know, as we prepare, you know, kind of narrowing down scenarios that are bothering players and asking them, you know, how are you practicing it? And a lot, you know, you'd be surprised. A lot of them really aren't conscious of how they're practicing it. They're just practicing it, you know, it's because they've always been good at it and maybe until now. And, you know, that they've never really thought about, okay, you know, if things do go wrong, where do I start? Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, you know, I tell people, you know, a lot of people hear mental coach and they think it's neck up, you know, I'm teaching people how to think. But you know, my big insight from stuttering is that stuttering is movement, you know, speaking is movement, is just as much as movement, you know, is involved in hitting golf shots. And, obviously the brain is coordinating every movement we make. And so, and the brain is doing incredible things to coordinate those movements. And, so a lot of that's kind of the underneath the hood type stuff, you know, goes into the practical strategies.
And it's something, you know, looking under the hood, it's a word that, gosh, golfers don't even like to say, right? But what are the Yips?
Yeah, you know, I think it's, you know, it can be called a lot of things, you know, it can be defined in a lot of ways, but it's the periodic loss of an automatic ability. You know, it's involuntary tension leading to not being able to perform as you desire in things that you have learned, you have mastered at a certain level. You know, we never call a bad golfer, and we never look at a golfer who's never been good and say, hey, they got the Yips. We just call them a bad golfer, right? But it afflicts, you know, athletes across the board. You know, one of the greatest stories last year, I thought, was the story of Tyler Matzik, the pitcher for the Braves. His performance in the World Series was just stellar. And, you know, that was a guy who literally 2 years before that was out of baseball, you know, couldn't, you know, throwing it straight into the ground, throwing it over the back screen, hitting batters. He figured out a way to do it. You know, the guy he worked with is a friend of mine now named Jason Kuhn. He's actually pretty close to me. I'm in Kentucky. He lives in Middle Tennessee, but you know, that story is fascinating. So, but getting back to defining it. Yeah. It's the loss of an automatic ability, whether it's, you know, obviously I'm talking to you now, so I have the automatic ability to speak, but since I stutter, you know, you might put me in a scenario, and I go to speak and like nothing comes out. So my movement is being inhibited, you know, or impeded at least. You know, sometimes it's like a bouncing type sound. Sometimes it's no air movement at all. And so, you know, a lot of times with yips in golf, you know. You know, we're obviously seeing the results. We're seeing like jabs, or we're seeing, you know, swings that don't look the same as on the range, or we're seeing, you know, chunk chips, gold chips, whatever it is. But at the end of the day, we're trying to get the body to move in a more efficient, smoother way under pressure.
Now, what's the best way to do that? You said it's not just, you know, a head up approach, right? I mean, in terms of, you know, getting someone to think differently, you can't just sort of say, okay, think differently. You know, you can't, experience in life, you get someone to think their way into right thinking. There also has to be action behind it to sort of like, it's like, how does one retrain your brain?
It's 100-100, right? And, you know, it's 100 mental, 100 action. And, and, you know, going back to kind of how the brain works in terms of orchestrating movement, you know, it works off two great inputs. And those inputs are memory and then real-time inputs. For the golfer, those real-time inputs would be a part of, you know, what we would call a pre-shot routine. Think information coming in through the senses that we can actually, you know, send information to the brain that can maybe calm it or put it in a more, a greater perception of control, or, you know, whatever it is we're trying to do, build comfort, as I call it. But the memory thing, the memory piece is the tricky piece, right? Because it's not really, you know, our memories are what they are. And so we can't really control those thoughts or feelings about potential outcomes, like what can potentially happen, you know, when I go to, you know, hit this putt or move this putter. And so a lot of the work I'm doing is helping players, what I call, kind of filter through their past memories. You know, in psychology, it can be called kind of reframing, or I call it kind of neutralizing the negatives. It's almost a form of, you know, in therapy, it's called kind of exposure therapy. That was really in Tyler's magic story. You know, your listeners go and read about that. You know, he was actually, they worked on the mechanics of his issues. But once the mechanics were in a little better place, he was taken out to a ball field in Middle Tennessee, away from the limelights of the Atlanta Braves Stadium. And his coach hired people to come in for the day and lay down 20 feet in front of the mound, you know, where he spiked balls, for people to walk around the mound talking about all his failures, for video cameras, you know, to be up playing his past yips, and kind of a full immersion type program, right? Where people are, you know, learning to be comfortable, you know, with the uncomfortable, you know. And kind of going back to my story is, I was lucky to have a great speech therapist in elementary school. And this is back in the 80s. And one of the things she did was more or less a principle in performance coaching, or performance psychology, as you call it. And it's basically helping players become comfortable being uncomfortable. And one of the things she did was every Wednesday we would go into a room and we would call Dillard's department stores, because the phone was very difficult for me. And we would basically ask for what color sweaters that they had on the rack that day. And so I call them kind of every player, you know, every yipper, or every, you know, player just working through obstacles and, you know, on their way to their championships, needs to have red sweater moments. Yeah. And so I try to create a lot of red sweater moments for my players in kind of a guided way. Like I'm there with them through it, right?
Yeah.
But once you do that, you're really impacting that inner environment that the brain is kind of drawing on to determine, you know, how the body is going to move.
How do you create a red sweater? I don't want to, you know, get, I want to give away all your trade secrets here, Ward, but how do you create some of those red sweater moments for someone that's struggling with the putting yips or the chipping yips, or any examples of, how do you get someone to feel the golf course? I mean, I feel uncomfortable on the golf course all the time, and no one has to try very hard, but those are my own shortcomings. But are there ways to sort of create that for somebody?
Well, there, you know, one thing is just talking about it. And a lot of times I'll talk about it while my player is practicing. You know, Michael Phelps is, it was asked a lot in interviews about the role of visualization and imagery in his preparation. And he says that, you know, I obviously spend some time envisioning perfect races and things going perfectly, but the majority, 90% of my visualization and imagery is spent in problem solving and seeing things going wrong in the middle of races and visualizing and imagining myself, you know, working through my steps to swim the race I want to swim. And so it's a lot of that. You know, I encourage a lot of my players to do what I call problem solving visualization, and which is a lot more relevant for golf if you think about it. A lot of times we talk about visualize your perfect round, and you go out and two holes in, something's gone wrong, and you're like, visualization doesn't work, right?
I visualized two birdies, Doc, and you know, and I'm four over.
Exactly. So, but if you kind of Dave Allred, a performance coach who worked pretty extensively with Francesco Molinari, you know, he's got a book out called The Pressure Principle, and he calls it the ugly zone. So, you know, the red sweater is kind of my version of the ugly zone. And, you know, so I'll do, you know, performance practice games where I'll be out there, you know, talking about that yip they had in 2015 at this tournament, or talking about maybe a situation that might come, you know, during the week. And, and of course that's only if I feel like it can benefit them and they need it.
Absolutely. So it takes, like, you know, I've heard you talk about, you know, how the brain works by prediction, predicting behavior. Explain that a little bit, how that ties into our memories.
Yeah, it's a very unintuitive thing, right? It's kind of like, you know, an illustration I give is, well, you know, when it comes to movement, the brain is predictive rather than reactive, meaning the brain's not just sitting around waiting to be stimulated and then go from there. It's kind of like when we're driving in a car and someone pulls out in front of us, we slam on the brakes before we're even aware that we're slamming on the brakes, right? Yeah. And the way the brain is able to do that, it's like the brain knows, kind of like a thermostat or air traffic control. You know, it knows before it even happens that that's a potential when you're in a car, right? Or in that type of environment with those patterns. And so it's one of the actions that it's potentially preparing, you know, that has on the table at least, and all this stuff's unconscious, you know, it's below the level of awareness, is okay. Someone pulls out, you know, and that comes into your through your senses, in that case, visual, you know, it's just a matter of milliseconds before our foot's on the gas. And so that's a very unconscious thing, but you know, golf is this tricky mixture, right? Between, you know, there's a lot of conscious activity, and you can't just make golf just, you know, just totally reactive, like hitting a baseball or something. You know, it's like pitching. It's starting from scratch every single shot. And, you know, and so I always kind of laugh, you know, and when I hear maybe coaches just say, I'm just trying to make them more reactive. I'm like, more times than not, that's not going to work, you know? So I try to get my players focused on what we call automatic tasks. That's just things, you know, ways we can think, ways we can move our attention, ways we can, you know, use our voluntary muscle movement to just kind of remind ourselves that, hey, you know, we can move automatically. And I get them really focused on those tasks, you know, in the process of, you know, establishing and maintaining their focus through, you know, any type of distraction.
That's really interesting. So you're using action, movement, to help sort of maybe reshape some sort of neurological pathways, right?
Exactly. You know, like with unwanted tension, I tell you, you know, if you got tension in your forearms, the answer is not to just tell, you know, will yourself out of that tension.
Right.
The answer might be to squeeze your feet, you know, put voluntary tension on top of involuntary tension. A lot of times that kind of frees up the brain to say, oh, you know, I mean, just does it kind of automatically at times. So you got to kind of be strategic about these things.
Yeah, no, that resonates because, you know, I dealt with, you know, say even like something like panic or disorder, like people will tell you, well, calm down.
Yeah. Don't worry about it. It's my favorite.
Don't
right?
worry. Right.
How many times, you know, I got 11-year-old. How many times I find myself saying, don't worry. I'm just like, right? That is the worst advice in the world. But
And you need to do something physical to sort of tell your brain that everything's okay. And that is the only sort of release or relief that, in my experience, that I've had. So it's interesting. I mean, all of this comes back to, you know, how we think the sort of yips are sort of this sort of specialized freakish sort of thing, or in your case, stuttering is this very sort of unusual case that afflicts only, you know, everyone is afflicted by this sort of connection, uneasy connection sometimes between their mind and how their body is acting and how that doesn't Absolutely. Always connect.
Yeah, you know, and that kind of gets in the question, like, can it be cured? I say, well, it depends on how you define it, you know, and obviously you can do things that really kind of slow the behavior, but the underneath the hood stuff is always there. It's kind of like, it's as if, you know, it's a human capacity, right? It's a human capacity. If you put if the brain gets in the right conditions, every single human being can potentially experience the yips. Every golfer Yeah. can potentially experience it. So it's basically, you know, being okay with that capacity and just realizing that if I have that, it's just a part of negative human potential, you know, and everyone Yeah. carries around negative human potential. And you know, what I want to do is help people build up their best and not only build it up, but access it. Under pressure,
that's what, you know, environment. And that's interesting to me because
it's everything. Yeah.
Yips. Right. So I don't suffer from the yips per se, as we would define or care, you know, classically sort of think of them. But in a tournament, my swing changes and my misses change, mm-hmm. and my tempo changes. And so there's, you know, environment is having an impact, on the way, you know, my body is behaving, something that I thought was sort of a controlled behavior that I'd learned, my golf swing in a certain environment. It's different. What the hell can I do about that? Help me, Ward.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, in marketing, it's end of the aisle stuff. Like the stuff on the end of the aisle, we're more likely to buy, and marketers, you know that. Right. And it's kind of like, you know, if you go through, you know, what they tell, you know, if you're trying to diet, don't have the food in the house. It's kind of like you have some control over the environment. Right. And so mm-hmm. it's kind of looking at the furniture in your current inner environment, you know, your current mental environment, and then working to put some new pieces or rearrange the pieces that are already there. To create a structure, create an order, you know, because without, you know, I call it kind of a framework, without having kind of a mental template, you know, it's going to be really hard to focus under pressure, right? You got to know mm-hmm. like where you're going, right? It's one thing you might have a bad feeling and you know you need to get away from it, but if you don't have a clue on, okay, where I'm going and how I'm going to get there, you know, and even practice it from time to time, you're not going to be ready to do it under pressure. So,
Yeah, for sure. How do I practice that? If I'm going to it's not going to happen overnight, but because people would ask me, so I did a book called Paper Tiger where, you know, I tried to play pro golf for a year and a half at, you know, various levels and say, you know, what was the biggest thing holding you back there were a lot of things holding me back, but the biggest thing for me was really getting comfortable in my sort of tournament skin, right? Getting comfortable in that environment, where playing, teeing off in a 4-day tournament felt normal. I didn't play enough of them to where that ever felt normal to me. It always felt like I was at the big kids table. So is it just something through like practice, you know, talking about, you know, the brain works by prediction. Do we have to build up the experience to know that our brain can predict positive things in certain places? Or is there a way that I can fake it? Because that would be useful.
No, I mean, you certainly can't fake it, but you've got to figure out ways to give your brain healthy new experiences. You know, that's what I tell people. The brain's not really crying out for a perfect experience. Like in your case, it's not really crying out that Tom's going to pure every tee shot or hit every shot solid. But it's just when we get in those ruts, it's just like, Tom, do something different, right? Do yeah. something different. And so the question becomes like, well, you know, what are those things? And of course, it's kind of, you know, the space I camp out in. And, you know, it's a lot of experimenting to find those things for the individual. You know, I know what's worked and, you know, what's my players have had success with. And it's not a one size fits all, you know. So there's a lot of collaboration. There's a lot of experimenting. But we don't change the structure, right? We don't change the framework. You know, those are fundamentals, so to speak. But yeah, you know, when it comes to the average golfer, you know, just think about the scenarios that bother you, and it might be being intentional about practicing. You know, if you're struggling with chipping, well, go out on a crowded day and chip in front of people. You know, especially if your chipping's better alone, right? Then that's probably a sign that your fundamentals are good enough. You know, if you're having trouble like alone, then there's probably a lot of mechanical work that we can do, right?
Yeah.
But if it's just appearing, it may be more so or more pronounced in front of people. That well, then you know, hit some chips in front of people and.
Get uncomfortable.
Laugh it off when the ball goes sculling across the green. You know, I do this today at my home course. I just, you know, and every now and then, you know, I'll hit a, you know, I'll skull a chip or chili dip it or whatever, you know.
That fear of what people are thinking of you is pretty damn powerful, isn't it?
It's you know, I think at the end of the day that's what turns the successful, high-powered executive, you know, in one space into a bundle of nerves. You know, yeah. Standing on the tee, right?
Yeah.
You know, and just the personalities we bring, you know, whether it's the perfectionism, you know, the beliefs around, you know, I can will myself through this, you know, all that kind of goes into making golf just such an incredible, just revelation into the mind and just how we're all basically wired at the end of the day.
Oh, no doubt about it. And I think, I mean, God, there was a first time when I had major first tee issues. But I've gotten to a point in my life where I realized like what I care much less about what people think of me, not in a cocky or obnoxious way. I'm just too old to give it, you know, you get to a point where like, who cares? And then, but also someone pointed out to me, they're like, you know, people aren't really all sitting around thinking about you. They're like worried. They're having the same worries and anxieties that you are about what you're thinking about them. So like, it's a lot of, you know, get your ego under control. The whole world isn't sitting around judging you.
Yeah. And you know, it's the basic desire to care about what people think about us is good, right? If we didn't, we'd be sociopaths if we had no concern for what others think of us. So
for sure.
It's not an issue of not caring what people think about it. It's just kind of ordering that.
Right.
That whole issue, exactly. Right? And being able to, okay, that's just another issue that I've got to focus through. And, you know, when I'm playing golf, that's the same maybe as a wind in my face and a bad yardage. It's they're right. All just the same distractions.
Now, Ward, if we can do this, if we can take the energy out of some of these memories and, speaking of memory, so friend of the program, one Large Randall or Big Randy or Phil Landis from No Laying Up likes to practice something called the mental miss, where as he's standing over a putt, he imagines missing it before he takes the club back and he swears by it. Now, after we've had this conversation, what I thought was the worst mental strategy in golf, maybe not the worst.
Maybe brilliant. Well, the those guys, it spent some time with Brendan. They spent a couple of weeks on the Brendan Todd store. They called it Dragon Sling, and I thought that was a great title for maybe a book down the road. But yeah. You know, I mean, I've heard, you know, Nicklaus took that strategy. You know, he wasn't afraid to. He would look at the trouble and then hone in on what his intention was going to be. You know.
Okay.
So it's there's definitely something to that. Like the brain can take in negative information. I mean, that's what we're wired to take in negative information. That's part of what keeps us alive. You know, negative memories naturally stay stronger than things we interpret as positive initially. And that's just going back to our caveman days, I guess, you know, it was useful to learn from other people's mistakes and bad things that happened to others so they didn't happen to you. So,
yeah,
you know, there's nothing unusual about it being harder to shake, you know, bad memories. But
now if we can,
yeah,
if we can shake some of those bad memories, or if we can take them on, look at them and put them in a jar, you know, acknowledge them and put them to the side, you know, we're in a better place. And then that maybe allows us to get into where I've read you talk about flow. Tell me about flow. I want it. I like it. I just like the sound of it.
Exactly. You know, I think one of the biggest misconceptions about flow is people think it's a lack of consciousness. It's like this unconscious state. But the thing about flow, it's not a lack of consciousness. It's a lack of self-consciousness in the moment. It's a complete task consciousness. It's like the fighter pilot is up in the plane and he's just one with that wheel, right? Mm-hmm. Or the stick. You know, it's just like this perfect kind of mesh between task and environment. You know, it's been said that, you know, that's kind of the way animals experience the world. Like, they don't really have the ability, you know, at least as much as we do, to have that self-consciousness, that self-reflection, that self-awareness. You know, it's just they're just living by, you know, biological intentions, right? Which we all have. So it's not a lack of consciousness. It's just a complete, almost lack of self-consciousness. And I call it temporary lack, because we always come back to ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we always come back to our goals. We always come back to, you know, our fulfillments, our disappointments. But, you know, while we're competing, you know, if we can remind ourselves that, hey, you know, that self will be there after this shot or after this round, and we can afford to temporarily kind of neglect it. You know, that's a big illustration I use with all my players. I call it, you know, it's the self is a good thing, but in creating success, you know, we have to ignore good things in order to focus. You know, whether it's, you know, if my little girl comes knocking on the door of my office, you know, while I'm talking to you, Tom, I have to ignore her, right, in order to focus on this conversation. That doesn't mean that she's not a lot more important to me than you are, right? But temporarily, no, I have to ignore her. And it's kind of like on my Instagram, I did a little blurb on it. It's kind of like the nagging child pulling on his mom's, you know, legs, just begging for her attention. She says, son, I love you, but you're going to have to do without my attention for a while. And that's kind of where we are, kind of in the competitive space. Like, self, I love you. I love your goals. But right now I got to be all in on these tasks.
I try every time I leave for golf. I give that talk to the family, and but they don't seem as moved or as convinced by it. But now I'll tell them about flow.
Exactly.
Now, so yeah, I mean, so we're talking about, and you know, that's a very, you hear people talk about, you know, being present and sort of, and sort of that mindfulness. And so this is sort of, the athletic version of it. I love that notion, like taking yourself out of something and just being task oriented. Any strategies, for finding the flow? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's got well marked, you know, parameters. You know, it's obviously high challenge and high skill. So anytime we have a challenge and our skills are, we feel like are well matched to that challenge, we're going to be more apt to be able to get into that flow state. So, you know, knowing your challenges, number one, and building the relevant skills, whether that's through, you know, mental skills training, which I do a lot of, whether it's, you know, through a combination of, you know, becoming better mechanically, and just learning how to mesh the two. But learning to ignore yourself or say no to yourself in order to be taken wholly up into a task. So just learning about it, I think, is the first step, understanding it, you know. You know, the book Flow is very formative, very influential in my journey, obviously. And just, you know, flow-based psychology is fascinating, because it doesn't just touch sports. It actually touches every aspect of our life, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we can pursue flow in in every kind of competitive domain or domains that every domain that matters to us, whether it's our family life, our business, our, you know, athletic pursuits, it's just all around, you know, performance. And performance for me is at the end of the day is just the process we go through to not only reach our goals, but formulate our goals and execute our goals.
Formulate our goals, execute our goals. Is formulating the easy part?
I think it's actually one of the harder, trickier parts, because when you do, you know, coming up with a big goal, I want to win a golf tournament or I want to make the tour, you know, that's the easy stuff, right? Or I want to be successful. I mean, that's kind of the who doesn't, right? It's kind of like, okay, that's my big win. That's my big goals. But what's going to get me there? Those are the small wins, the small goals. Yeah, so, you know, just figuring out, you know, what those small goals can be, you know, kind of getting back to a lot of the red sweater moments that we talked about, you know, that those are kind of small wins that ultimately, you know, go into big wins.
Hmm. Love it. So who wrote the book Flow? Maybe our Broken Tea Society book club should check it out. Who wrote it?
I know you're going to ask me this. And I get Mahali Mick Kilsmichek. That is his name.
Of course.
So I don't think I'm not super ashamed that I can't pronounce it. I don't have the. I should have breaking down the pronouncement of it. But if you look it up, it's a standard work. You know, he studied it and kind of put the scholarship out there. And everyone kind of stands on his shoulders.
Getting into the flow in other parts of our lives and how, like, you know, if we can sort of the things that are behind the yips, the things that were behind stuttering, they can be behind so many different behavior patterns in our lives that would be better if we let go of certain things and lived more in flow. I don't have a lot of flow in my life golf wise, but there's been times when, like, you know, you really feel like, you're just really into the game and in the moment, and that's great, and it's as close as I've gotten. But I can relate to it as a writer, and I'm not always in the zone or flowing as a writer. I mean, it's usually a lot of work and slog, but there are times when, you know, you sit down to work on something and you look up and it's 4 hours later, and you know, and I'm not saying what I wrote that day was any good or whatever, but I was intent. I was very much in the task and was not aware of everything else going on around me, including, you know, Golfers Journal Zoom calls and meetings and things like that, you know, because I was in the flow, I guess. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Well, you know, golf is really interesting because it really doesn't require, obviously, no one's going to be in the flow for 72 holes unless you're maybe Tiger Woods in 2000, right? Yeah. I'd say maybe amongst, you know, in 72 hole event, maybe a golfer who wins might have six to nine holes of flow during that. If at all, they don't really have to get in a total flow state to win a golf tournament. But, you know, what's interesting, a lot of books are being written on it. A lot of these sports now that grab our attention, you know, whether it's Alex Honnold, you know, doing free solo, you know, that's an endeavor where if he's not in flow, he dies, you know, and a lot of this high risk stuff that we watch on TV where it's motocross and all these feats, you know, in golf, we just got to stay out there and be embarrassed and, you know, just finish out, right? However many strokes it takes us. But, you know, and that's one of the things, that was one of Brendan's, you know, takeaways, like, you know, in a rock climber, if he knows he's on flow, if he cares about his life at all, he's going to come down and quit. You know, like Brendan said, I don't have the option to quit during the middle of a round. Right. And so that's kind of the difference in golf when it comes to flow and other endeavors, you know, related to flow. That's a super interesting topic.
It is. Where do you think the future, where is this all going? the future of, you know, the science behind that's looking at, you know, whether, you know, movement disorders or, you know, the connection between mind and body, you know, as it relates to the yips or studying, or even things like, you know, Parkinson's and that those sort of involuntary.
Yeah. It's great that you just brought that up. You know, a lot of stuttering research I know is tied to Parkinson's research. You know, a lot of the neuroscientific, research, there's so much overlap, right? And so in terms of where it's going, you know, it's kind of an open question. I think there's a lot of potential to improve virtual reality options when it comes to training for athletics. I think that's a really cool potential avenue for people to be involved in at some level. I think just the awareness, I think, in society of, you know, a lot of athletes are bringing more and more awareness to mental health and its relationship to performance and longevity and, you know, burnout and all those issues that, you know, we all face, obviously. But it's getting easier and easier to talk about, you know, whether it's Simone Biles, you know, going through her issues, obviously, you know, our hero, you know, Tiger, you know, the cost, he had a lot of cost to his greatness and his, and so there's always a cost, you know, to any type of ultimate greatness. You know, as Warren Buffett says, you know, his main advice is that, you know, the super successful, what they do is that they say no to almost everything. And I like, you know, I work with a lot of my players on the things you're having to say no to aren't just bad things. It's a lot of good things. And so, that takes its toll on you. And so, yeah, whether it's mental health, whether it's future of training and virtual reality, whether it's connections with things that impact our family's lives, whether it's, you know, sickness, disease, whatever, you know, or just like you said, just trying to get in flow and in everyday life. I think it's, there are a lot of fascinating ways that we could go with it.
Yeah, it might be a chemical sort of, you know, so I had a coach once, a friend of mine, we had the same coach, and my friend was struggling with the chipping yips, and he had the cure. He told him two beers and a Xanax before he teed off, which for our coach worked great, but it's difficult to apply that regimen. And, you know,
yeah, and keep going life. To work day in, day out, and keep being right. A spouse and be a respectable parent and everything. Yeah. And that yeah. Definitely works, you know, temporarily, but the longevity of those strategies, you know, bring a lot of other unwanted issues into your life eventually.
No doubt about that. But yeah, so these are more healthy. There are more healthy exercises to feeling comfortable in uncomfortable situations. There are other ways to do that. And man, that applies to a lot of things in everybody's lives. Whatever we're doing to try to feel normal or fit in or play the way we think we're supposed to play, all those sorts of things. Sometimes we're doing it productively and sometimes we're doing it destructively. In any event, thank you so much, Ward, for taking us through. It's fascinating stuff. I could talk about this relationship between, you know, our mind, action, environment. I think it is absolutely fascinating. Just leave us with, for someone who might be listening, who's struggling with that fear, who thinks the next time they're going to go out and they have a chip off a tight lie that there's no way they're going to hit the ball first, that they're going to yip a chip, or that when they bring the putter back, that they're going to hit the ground first. You know, what can you give them to give them a little hope?
Well, I would just like to think, you know, some of the stories of my players, whether it's the Brendan Todd story, you know, I've written about it. You know, they can find that at my website at wardjarvis.com. I've written about that, you know, posted about, you know, some things that, you know, some of the best golfers in the world are doing to work through their challenges. So, you know, that's a great place to start. And just recognizing that, you know, you're not alone. It's you can strategize and mobilize against the challenge. And there is hope, you know, at the end of the day of smoothing out, you know, that rough experience. But it all boils down to, you know, understanding, and then from that understanding, you know, following some strategy.
And you've got the strategies, and the strategies are out there. And there is hope. That's awesome. Ward, thank you so much for your time. Your story is an inspiration, and thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely, Tom. Enjoyed being with you.